Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is, the daily magazine program from VOA Learning English. Today, we hear how women in Lebanon are carrying out diplomacy in the kitchen. But first, I bring you a story about India's effort to stop families from ending pregnancies when the fetus is a girl. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has spoken out against the practice, which is causing serious social problems in the world's second most populous country. For many years, Indian families seemed more interested in having boys than girls. This choice of boys has led to many illegal abortions. Doctors were told to end a pregnancy when the fetus showed signs of being female. This custom has also led to a big problem in India. There are not enough girls compared to all the boys. The falling number of girls presents a major social issue for the country. In a strong message, Prime Minister Narendra Modi told Indians that we cannot be counted as citizens of the 21st century. He said aborting female fetuses is worse than an 18th century way of thinking, because girls are being killed even before they are born. Mr. Modi said that valuing sons above daughters is an emotional disorder, and he called for a social awakening to see girls as valuable as boys. The Prime Minister says no mother wants to do away with her child, but he adds family and social pressures make her involved in this crime. In the traditional culture in India, sons are considered a valuable resource. They can earn money for the family and take care of parents in their old age. Girls are considered a liability, bringing financial pressure on the mother and father. That is because the parents have to give a dowry, usually money or property, to the family of the girl's husband. Ultrasound technology has made knowing the sex of the unborn possible. Studies show that during the past 40 years, as many as 12 million girls may have been aborted. Mr. Modi launched the campaign to Save the Daughter, Teach the Daughter in the northern state of Haryana. The state has the lowest number of girls to boys in India, 879 for 1,000 males. The national average is 917 girls for 1,000 males. The campaign aims to reduce the sharp difference in the number of male and female births. It will seek to improve equality of the sexes through education. The program will enforce existing laws that ban the abortion of female fetuses. It will also seek to improve attendance of girls in schools. Aborting female fetuses takes place in every class of Indian society. The poor and rich, urban and rural, uneducated and educated, often want sons. In fact, researchers found that choosing to abort a female fetus is more common among educated women. They also found that religion made no difference. The International Development Research Center carried out the study. Last year, a United Nations report warned the lessening number of girls in India has reached an emergency level. It said this lack of women has caused an increase in some crimes, such as the kidnapping and trafficking of women. Next, Anna Mateo has a story about an unlikely source of diplomacy in the fighting taking place in Lebanon.
When you hear the words, peace talks, what do you imagine? Perhaps you think of heads of state, diplomats, or other high government officials. But what if the peace talks looked like this? All the government officials stayed at home and instead sent their mothers and grandmothers. These women could meet in a kitchen, around a kitchen table. While the women prepare food together, they could talk about how to solve the problems between their families. A kind of mother knows best diplomacy, you might say. In a way, that is what is happening in Tripoli, Lebanon's second largest city. Years of fighting there have split some neighborhoods. The Syrian war and the actions of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad have made tensions worse. Long-running tensions in Tripoli led to new clashes in October 2014. Fighting between gunmen and the Lebanese army caused thousands of people to flee their homes. The involvement of Islamist militants in the fighting increased fears that the self-declared Islamic State was attempting to gain support in Lebanon. One street in Tripoli is on the front line of this conflict. This street divides a neighborhood along sectarian or religious lines. But between these two fighting groups is a kitchen. This kitchen is a place where women from both sides work together to earn a living. These women bring hope that years of hatred can be put aside in the name of good food. Women from the opposing sides are coming together to cook, thanks to a non-profit organization, Ruwad al-Tanmeya Lebanon. Experienced chefs helped the women complete training. Now, they are earning a living by selling their food to organizations such as the Red Cross. Sarah El-Cherif heads the organization. She says the aim is not just to unite the women, but to empower them too.
Now, in this project, they realize that now we are sharing the same pain, but now we are sharing the same purpose. So we started to share the same purpose, which is we want to get income, to generate income, in order for us to support our families financially. And when you give them the access to start empowering themselves financially, then you are empowering indirectly their families educationally.
These women will continue cooking together and breaking down the barriers of hatred with each meal they make and sell. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thank you, Anna. And that's our show for today. Listen again tomorrow for another As It Is program on The Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Thank you. Now the VOA Special English Program, Words and Their Stories.
Cold weather has a great effect on how our minds and our bodies work. Maybe that is why there are so many expressions that use the word cold. For centuries, the body's blood has been linked closely with the emotions. People who show no human emotions or feelings, for example, are said to be cold-blooded. Cold-blooded people act in cruel ways. They may do brutal things to others, and not by accident. For example, a newspaper says the police are searching for a cold-blooded killer. The killer murdered someone, not in self-defense or because he was reacting to anger or fear. He seemed to kill for no reason and with no emotion, as if taking someone's life meant nothing. Cold can affect other parts of the body. The feet, for example. Heavy socks can warm your feet if your feet are really cold. But there is an expression, to get cold feet, that has nothing to do with cold or your feet. The expression means being afraid to do something you had decided to do. For example, you agree to be president of an organization, but then you learn that all the other officers have resigned. All the work of the organization will be your responsibility. You are likely to get cold feet about being president when you understand the situation. Cold can also affect your shoulder. You give someone the cold shoulder when you refuse to speak to them. You treat them in a distant, cold way. The expression probably comes from the physical act of turning your back toward someone instead of speaking to him face to face. You may give a cold shoulder to a friend who has not kept a promise he made to you, or to someone who has lied about you to others. A cold fish is not a fish. It is a person. But it is a person who is unfriendly, unemotional, and shows no love or warmth. A cold fish does not offer much of himself to anyone. Someone who is a cold fish could be cold-hearted. Now, a cold-hearted person is someone who has no sympathy. Several popular songs in recent years were about cold-hearted men or cold-hearted women who, without feeling, broke the hearts of their lovers. Out in the cold is an expression often heard. It means not getting something that everybody else got. A person might say that everybody but him got a pay raise, that he was left out in the cold, and it is not a pleasant place to be.
This VOA Special English Program, Words and Their Stories, was written by Marilyn Cristiano. Morris Joyce was the narrator. I'm Shirley Griffith.
I'm Mary Tillotson.
And I'm Steve Ember with the VOA Special English Program, People in America. Today we begin a two-part story about songwriter and singer Woody Guthrie. He wrote songs about common people and social issues in the 1930s. His music influenced many people.
Imagine you are in America in the 1930s. A train passes through the countryside. It is nighttime, and the only sound that can be heard is the long, lonely whistle coming from the train's engine. Inside the train's boxcars are groups of men sitting or lying on the floors. The men are dirty, and their clothing is torn. In one boxcar, a short man with long, curly brown hair is playing a guitar and singing. His name is Woody Guthrie. He is singing a song about men who look for work as they travel from town to town.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore. My brothers and my sisters are stranded on this road, a hot and dusty road that a million feet have trod. Rich man took my home and drove me from my door, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
Woodrow Wilson Guthrie was born in 1912 in the American state of Oklahoma. The Guthrie family lived in a small farming town called Okima. Woody's father, Charles, was a businessman who bought and sold land. Woody's mother, Nora, was a school teacher. She also liked to play the piano and sing. When Woody was young, his mother sang him songs she had learned as a girl. These songs told stories about love and death and difficult times.
Woody's early years were happy ones, but his life began to change when he was only 10 years old. One day, his sister, Clara, spilled oil on her dress and accidentally set herself on fire. She died the next day. Woody never forgot her death. As time passed, Woody's mother began acting strangely. She lost control over her actions and speech. Many people thought she was insane. Because of this, the Guthrie family became more private as they attempted to hide Nora's problems. The loss of his daughter and his wife's suffering ruined Charles Guthrie. He began drinking alcohol. His business soon failed. The Guthrie family left Okima and lived in several towns in Oklahoma and Texas. Young Woody often had to work instead of attending school because his family was poor.
The first musical instrument Woody learned to play was the harmonica. He learned to play the harmonica by watching an old man play the instrument. Woody learned how to play the guitar by watching his father's brother play. In the 1920s, Woody was living in the town of Pampa, Texas. Pampa was known as a boom town because it had grown quickly after oil was discovered nearby. On weekends, Woody joined other young men to play music at dances in the town. Years later, Woody described what singing meant to him. When you sing a song, it reaches out and enters people's ears. It makes them jump up and down and sing it with you. The best part about singing is that you can sing what you think. You can tell all kinds of stories in a song and put your ideas across to another person.
Woody liked to communicate with other people through his music. Yet he did not like to say much about himself. One reason for this was that he did not want people to know that his mother was in a hospital for insane people. Nora Guthrie suffered from Huntington's chorea, a disease that destroys the brain and nervous system. Woody knew that someday he also might develop the disease. He was 17 years old when his mother died in 1929. That was the year when the economy of the United States began to slow down. Over the next several years, many Americans lost their jobs. The period became known as the Great Depression. In Pampa, the oil fields dried up. Farms in many areas failed because little or no rain fell for several years. The land became so dry that wind easily blew away the topsoil. These areas of Texas, Oklahoma, and other states became known as the Dust Bowl.
Like many other people, Woody Guthrie left Pampa to travel around Texas and the Southwest looking for work. He often made trips by train. But because he had no money, he would jump on the train's boxcars and ride for free. This was often dangerous, because guards on the train would throw the men off or arrest them. However, Woody found this life exciting. One of the first songs he wrote was about leaving home and fleeing the Dust Bowl.
So long, it's been good to know you. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is a-blowing me home. I've got to be rolling along. I'll sing this song, but I'll sing it again, of the place that I lived on the West Texas plains. In the city of Pampa, the county of Gray, here's what all of the people there say. Well, it's so long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been
Woody Guthrie married Mary Jennings in 1933. They had three children. 3 years later, Woody left his family and traveled to California. He met many kinds of people during his travels. He also learned songs from many different parts of the country. Yet what affected him most was the suffering he saw. He said, "When I saw hard-working people suffering under debts, sickness, and worries, I knew there was plenty to make up songs about."
In California, Woody earned money by playing his guitar and singing. Later, he began performing on a radio program with a friend, Maxine Chrisman. She was called Lefty Lou. They had one of the most popular radio programs in Los Angeles. They sang songs Woody had written about social issues. His best songs were about the troubles Americans faced during the Depression. This song is about the dangers of coal mining. It is called The Dying Miner.
It happened an hour ago, way down in this tunnel of coal. The gas caught fire from somebody's lamp, and the miners are choking in smoke. Goodbye to Dickie and Honey. Goodbye to the wife that I love. A lot of these men not coming home tonight when the work whistle blows. Dear sisters and brothers, goodbye. Dear mother and father, goodbye. My fingers are weak and I cannot write. Goodbye, Centralia, goodbye.
In 1938, Woody Guthrie left the radio program to travel around California. He found that conditions had become worse for many people who had lost their land and fled the Dust Bowl. Most of these Dust Bowl refugees could only find seasonal farm work, like gathering fruit from trees. Farm owners did not pay these workers much money. The workers lived in camps that were often dirty and had no running water. Hunger and sickness were widespread. The people in the camps seemed to have lost all hope of improving their lives. Woody wrote a song about them called Dust Bowl Refugees.
I'm a Dust Bowl refugee, just a Dust Bowl refugee. From that Dust Bowl to the Peach Bowl, now that peach fuzz is killing me. Cross the mountains to the sea, come the wife and kids and me. It's a hot old dusty highway for a Dust Bowl refugee. Hard it's always been that way, here today and on our way. Down that mountain, across the desert, just a Dust Bowl refugee. We are ramblers.
The oppression and bad conditions in the workers' camps made Woody Guthrie angry. He began helping labor organizers establish unions to help the workers. Next week, we tell about how he traveled to New York City and became a well-known musician.
This special English program was written by Shelley Gollist. It was produced by Paul Thompson. Our studio engineer was Audrius Regis. I'm Mary Tillotson.
And I'm Steve Ember. Join us again next week for another People in America program on the Voice of America.